After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the Real Love podcast series, right here on the Sharon Salzberg Metta Hour. This series features a variety of conversations with some of the world's finest teachers and thinkers, all exploring Sharon's new book, Real Love, The Art of Mindful Connection. Real Love is a field guide for anyone seeking awakened living in the 21st century. To get your copy of Real Love, visit SharonSalzberg.com. This podcast is brought to you by the Be Here Now Network. If you're interested in supporting this podcast, please visit www.BeHereNowNetwork.com/Sharon.
Hi, I'm Sharon Salzberg, and I am so happy to be speaking today with my very good friend, Ethan Nichtern. Ethan is a second-generation meditation teacher and the author of several books, including his brand-new release, The Dharma of the Princess Bride, which comes out on September 12, 2017. For the past 15 years, Ethan has taught meditation and Buddhist psychology classes and workshops around New York City and North America and Europe. He primarily studies in the Shambhala tradition under Sakyong Wipam Rinpoche, but has also studied Theravada and Soto Zen Buddhism. Ethan is a Shastri, a senior teacher in the Shambhala Buddhist tradition, and currently he's senior teacher in residence for the Shambhala New York City community. Welcome, Ethan. So somebody was just asking me when we met. Do you remember? I don't remember. I've always known you, Ethan.
I don't remember exactly when we met, but we've been close for a while now.
Yes.
It's really great to have you as a mentor, teacher, friend, a wedding officiant.
Yes. That was secret, Ethan. Never mind.
It's in the book.
Oh, so. Okay. I must have missed that. I remember your dad asking me to teach for you at the Interdependence Project. And then you and I became such good friends. I see you much more often than I see your dad, you know.
Well, when was IDP getting going? 2006, 2007. So it's been the last 10 years.
Yeah,
I see you more often than I see my dad, too, I think.
That's great.
He's a world traveler.
So I am so excited about your new book. I have to confess, I've only seen a little bit of the movie, The Princess Bride, and I turned it on this friend's Netflix when I was out in California because of your book. So still, you know, I think I got the, I hope I got the thesis of it. Can you tell everyone a little bit about the book and the history of the film in your life?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, for people who love The Princess Bride, which is most people, not to exclude you, but I think the references to The Princess Bride really helped the book, but it's not really about The Princess Bride. It's about studying Buddhism, meditating, trying to figure out relationships in an era of pop culture. And for that reason, The Princess Bride, as a sort of very contemporary fairy tale, plays a really dominant role. So, I mean, let's see. The book came from, I wanted to write about relationships, but I really didn't want to write and struggling with relationships as a meditator and Buddhist practitioner. But I didn't want to write from the perspective of being a relationship expert. That's actually one of the main themes of the book, that, you know, there are great guides to help us with relationships, but the term itself, relationship, actually means at least two people, and expert is one lone person. So it's actually an oxymoron. And so I wanted to find a way that could write about relationships with more transparency and more sort of personal story. And also, I think I really wanted to honor popular culture's role in a modern spiritual practitioner's life. And I remember that part came out of my first publisher, Wisdom Publications, which published my first book, One City. I remember that they had published a book called The Dharma of Star Wars, which is more kind of, it's a really cool book, but it's kind of a analysis of the Jedi Code from a Buddhist perspective. And I remember seeing that and saying, if I ever do something like that, it's going to be about the Princess Bride. And so this idea kind of came together to, you know, then I started looking at when The Princess Bride came out. I was talking to my friend and agent, Lisa Weinert, and, you know, she said, well, when did the movie come out? And she was thinking about more from like an anniversary kind of like, when is a good time to write about this? And it turned out it came out in the fall of 1987. So we're coming up on the 30th anniversary, September 25th. And I just looked back at where my life was. And that was, you know, fourth grade, which is exactly the age almost of the grandson, Fred Savage, in the movie. And that was a crazy, crazy year in the life of my formative family relationships. That was the year my parents, Buddhist teacher Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, passed away very early. It was a really pretty difficult event for both my parents and a lot of their friends. That was the year my grandfather and his wife committed double suicide. That was the year my parents split up. So there was this real sort of beloved fairy tale coming into my life at the same time that my life as a sort of formative child was really hard, and everything sort of dovetailed when I started writing. So it turned out to be, you know, a kind of let's look at 30 years of trying to study and practice meditation and Buddhism, 30 years of loving this pop culture classic, The Princess Bride, and 30 years trying to be in relationships, friendship, romance, and family. So it's kind of a cocktail, you know, of different, and I think the early reviews, people have said it works really well as sort of this cross narrative. You know, it was just the kind of book that felt right to write. And so that's where that came from.
Yeah, no, I was going to ask about that year because, I mean, what a traumatic and unbelievable kind of year. I mean, any one of those things, of course, is a major upheaval. And
Yeah. And was having a hard time in school, too. So it was just, you know, I don't even remember completely loving The Princess Bride that year. The reason I went to see it is that my father's best friend, when he was growing up, was in the movie. He was the actor Christopher Guest, who plays one of the bad guys in the movie, the six-fingered man. And so it was kind of this, I had never read the book, The Princess Bride. It was kind of this relief. And as a nine-year-old, you can tell, like, this is a weird fairy tale. But it was just, I think, provided a little bit of relief. And as the years have gone by, I think one of the reasons the movie didn't actually do that well in the cinema, it was like 41st at the box office that year. But 538.com recently did a survey of the 25 most rewatchable movies of all time, and Princess Bride is number 6. So it's literally like in American people's minds, it's the most memorable movie that you would want to watch again.
Actually, even just when you say you were 9, I was 9 when my mother died, and that the little kid was 9 in the film, or around that age. So
yeah.
I remember just the fraction of the movie that I saw, just the tenderness of that relationship, how his grandfather, right, like hangs in there even no matter what the kid throws up in his face, you know, like.
So it's a real lineage moment, too. That's the other thing about the setup, is it's this wacky, deconstructed fairy tale that the grandfather's telling his grandson. But that just felt like another really strong connection, because my father always refers to Chogyam Trungpa as his spiritual father. Mm-hmm. So kind of playing on that notion of a lost grandfather, even though he was probably too young to be my grandfather. And then, you know, my grandpa Saul committing suicide that year, there's a real sense of that connection to one's lineage in that sense. And I think Princess Bride is kind of, there's a lineage transmission, to put it in Buddhist terms, going on in the storytelling.
Yeah. So is there some, I don't know, is there like one character? Was it the kid, or is there something that resonates the most for you?
Yeah. I mean, I think in each of the three sections of the book, there's sort of a drawing on one of the relationships, like in this first section, which is on friendship, the relationship between Andre the Giant's really sweet, kind of idyllic bodhisattva, generous friendship character of Fezzik, and Mandy Patinkin's Inigo Montoya, their sort of friendship and how they help each other and then help the star of the movie, Wesley. That was pretty dominant in the second part of the movie about the second part of the book about working with romance and dating, romantic partnership, marriage, sort of the Wesley and Buttercup characters really became prominent. And then in the third part of the book, it's all about the grandfather and grandson and just thinking about family lineage. And, you know, the other thing I was thinking about, which gets into the conclusion about being 9 years old, is there's a really famous story. It's actually not as famous as I wish it were, in the life of the Buddha, when he's a few months shy of his awakening and he's left his ascetic life behind, and he has this sudden recollection of being nine years old. I don't think the sutta actually says what age he is, but Thich Nhat Hanh says he was 9 years old, and sitting in the fields next to his father's estates, watching them plow the fields, and just feeling spontaneously innocent and awake and liberated. And using that sort of positive nostalgia of a positive memory of just being who he was as a kind of final, almost visualization for his final awakening. So 9 years old is a pretty important
age. It's a big thing. Yeah, actually, in the Theravada, in the Burmese forms of Buddhism, the Buddha, then known as the Bodhisattva, because he had not yet attained Buddhahood, has that recollection in the form of a dream. He dreams it. And Mark Epstein, who's a psychiatrist, got really excited because it's a dream. There aren't many dreams to be analyzed in the tradition. But it's quite a moment. You know, there's a moment of release. There's a moment of not trying so hard. And also not, there's no pretense there. You know, he's remembering being a kid without the need to sort of impress anybody or, you know, fulfill a role or something like that. And so there's a lot about that age.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I also think it's, you know, in terms of, if you think of kind of the nature of mind as just this kind of, I mean, we think of it, it's hard to describe what awakening actually feels like. People always want to know. And a lot of times in classic Buddhism, it's described as the absence of a problem, you know, and they lay out the problems that are no longer there. And I always thought it was interesting that, you know, the word nirvana or nibbana literally means to extinguish. So the word actually means the opposite of enlightenment, which I always thought was kind of...
Oh, that's interesting. that's interesting.
So to frame it as like, what is the state of awakening or aliveness, you know... my teacher, Sakyamuni Paramahamsa, talks a lot about a sense of worthiness. And I really think about a sense of innocence. Like fundamentally, there's no wrongdoing and you can just be and connect with others. And so it's, that notion of being nine is just this interesting moment. And actually, you know, often thinking about this right now, because I have a 7-week-old daughter, at the time that we're talking about this, like fourth grade for me was this time where like you're no longer the cute kid, you know, people aren't just posting photos of their 9-year-old being like, oh my God, they're so cute. But you're also not quite a responsible tween or teen or grown up yet. And so that sort of in between phase of like, you're not innocent, but you're not burdened yet is an interesting sort of transitional moment.
So I guess a more cynical part of me would say it's one thing to experience that innocence and that kind of non-constructed persona, you know, that incredible authenticity of being sitting under a tree by yourself. But what about being in a relationship?
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about, I remember one time Dr. Jeffrey Rubin, who's also a Soto, I don't think he's a Zen practitioner. He said there was a slogan in certain Zen traditions that if you want to know if a master is enlightened, ask their spouse, ask his wife, but to degender it, ask their spouse. So that's, you know, that's kind of an interesting, you know, if you want to know if a person's awake, ask their friends, ask their students, ask the people who are close. And so I think that's the interesting thing, because I think there's a lot of myths. And that was the other thing about this book. I really, with no such thing as a relationship expert, you know, I think there's a lot of Eastern myths about relationships, that if you've sat in a cave for 12 years, you must be great at, you know, friendship or political disagreement or Thanksgiving with your family, you know, or fights with your romantic partner. And, you know, I also think that there's kind of Western myths, but the notion of innocence as a space of not knowing and actually being open to saying, like, what, how are we going to connect together? And there's lots, that's the thing about Buddhism, is there is very little specific advice in classic Buddhism about, like, let's say a second date isn't going well and you want to let the other person down compassionately. There's no specific instruction for how to do that, right? There's no specific instruction about how to get divorced compassionately. But there's so many great teachings about how to hold one's mind and heart open in a space that's not causing more harm and is maybe more generous. And but it's the really sticky part of practice. And I think that's why, even for the Buddha, you know, I say this somewhat blasphemously but hopefully lovingly in the book, that the Buddha was a deadbeat dad, you know. And you could, certain authors in describing his life have tried to give him sort of like this superhuman mythic being that, like, he saw the way forward and, you know, family was not it. But he was 29 years old. So in astrological terms, that's Saturn returns. And he had a 6-month-old. And I know having a baby can be, what do I do, you know? And I just imagine, what if the Buddha had a panic attack? You know, that's obviously not the way the story's told, and there's nothing in the sutras to say that that's what happened, but it's more humanizing, you know, it's more humanizing, you know, the famous story of the, probably the most famous teacher in my tradition, Acharya Pema Chodron, you know, talking about finding out her husband was cheating on her and throwing rocks at him, you know, so that sort of, how do we actually notice our shortcomings and then really show up? And there aren't really, I mean, there are great people in relationships who are masters of the tradition, but it's something I think we each have to be willing to practice. And we also have to share our own process. That's the thing, the other part of the book that feels important to me, especially with what's going on in some meditation communities, that you know, as a teacher, as well as a practitioner, I felt like it's really important to be transparent, not to be exhibitionist about one's own journey with these things, but to be transparent about, like, so you don't think that there's a kind of superhuman quality going on.
Well, before we go on, just in terms of the term deadbeat.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't leave his wife and child on the streets. Let's say he left them in the palace with the king and the, you know, the queen and the large extended family. I mean, just that part.
Yeah. You know. Okay. So if the term deadbeat means you have to leave them broke, then that, but I just meant he left them without a father and a husband.
You know,
and he definitely made that.
That is true.
And it, but it is interesting, like in Thich Nhat Hanh's version of the life of the Buddha, he goes to extensive to explain that it's actually the Buddha's narcissistic father who he's running away from, and that his wife fully supported that he wanted a spiritual life. And so it's just a version of storytelling without a freak out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just interesting what those versions of stories do. You know, they give us sort of these myths to worship.
Right.
And it's sort of like, well, how do I connect with that? Because we really connect more with a struggle, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
There are, like in my Buddhist tradition, there are archetypes for beings, you know, bodhisattvas or yidams that you focus on in meditation who represent the part of our mind or heart that's never been confused, that hasn't gone through a struggle, that's always been pristine and worthy and innocent and awake. But humans really represent a kind of struggle, and I think particularly a struggle with relationships.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, then there's the Western side of this, which is why I wanted to bring the Princess Bride in, is the Western side of this is the kind of rom-com myth that there's a perfect status-building partner and perfect set of friends and perfect life, and you'll get the perfect job, and it'll all come together, and all your relationships will be in just this beautiful space, and then roll credits. And I think the Princess Bride, because it makes the object of romantic affection named Buttercup, which is so ridiculous, it does a pretty good job of undercutting a lot of classic fairy tales. But it does it in this really interesting way, which I think is particularly Buddhist, which is it cuts through a classic sort of mythical narrative, but it doesn't do it just to leave you hopeless or feeling nihilistic or feeling cynical about relationships.
Mm-hmm.
It's, which like is a little bit more in the Game of Thrones end of the spectrum. It's just like, who's the good guy here, you know?
Actually, I don't know. I've never seen that either.
Well,
sorry.
It's okay. As a student and friend, I think it might be a little too violent for you.
Yeah, I think that's probably right.
But there's a quality of optimism. It's mm-hmm. It's a deconstruction in the service of true love.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of, I was talking to a friend and I was like, that's what we need more of, is optimistic or loving deconstructions in mm-hmm. the contemporary era. And he was like, yeah, mm-hmm. I like that. And that's what I think The Princess Bride is. And you know, I do think there's a lot of myths about relationships. So getting into that playful space where a personal practice and pop culture are kind of convening, that felt like a very fruitful place to write from, especially when I figured out sort of where I actually was the first time I saw The Princess Bride, which I had forgotten, and then the whole thing uh-huh. came together.
Where were you?
I mean...
The year?
The year,
yeah,
where I was in life. I mean.
So I have a funny question to ask you based on something you just said. As you know, I have a book that just came out called Real Love.
Yeah.
Which...
Love it.
Thank you. Which was not a title I chose, but was fine. Do you think... I mean, and when you said true love just now, I thought, oh, that's kind of... That evokes a different feeling, and... It made me like real love all the more,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. So true love is in The Princess Bride, true love, obviously true love sounds like the rom-com myth. It's the romantic version of it, which obviously real love is about. It's interesting how many different kinds and approaches to love you kind of got into that book. So true love is definitely coming from this sort of fairy tale place of romantic, you know, Prince Charming, etc., even though it's Princess Buttercup in this case. And I think that's what they're playing with. What's interesting is in The Princess Bride, what it really ends up being about, there's this notion of devotion in true love, which is sort of drawn out by this very famous phrase in the movie, as you wish, that's the activity of devotion, is you just say as you wish to your true love. But then it flips that... the actual meaning of true love is between the grandfather and the grandson,
yeah.
because the
yeah.
movie ends with the grandfather saying, as you wish. And so I think they're playing with, and I think it's also like Tantric Buddhism, the tradition that I primarily practice, there is this notion of finding that line between devotional longing and yearning and almost erotic affection, and then how that could open you up to true love for everyone. But yeah, I think true love works in The Princess Bride just because it's such a fairy tale But I think real love, you know, I think that's the other thing. I think the reason I like the word real is that there's a kind of authenticity. And that's sort of where our world is at. Like, can we just get real? Can we drop all the garbage and just like tell me what's really going on for you? What's really going on here? And it's a good time for us to get real because we got a lot of problems, you know.
Yeah.
The city of Houston is underwater right now with 2 more feet of rain expected.
I know, and because I was traveling and I was. Reading all the news on Twitter, as I do. And then, you know, I saw the hurricane getting downgraded. And I thought, oh, great. You know, I felt such a sense of relief. And then all of a sudden, it was awful enough, you know, with just being a tropical storm. I mean, truly awful. And, this recent period started out with me writing to everyone I knew in Charlottesville, which is quite a number of people, you know. And then I was writing to everyone I knew in Houston. And then, you know, it's quite a lot going on.
So I'm just, can I ask you,
yeah.
Did you have an original title for the book that then got edited?
I don't think for this one. It was more just, oh yeah, that's what it'll be called. There was some changes around the subtitle. The actual title is Real Love, The Art of Mindful Connection, I think. Mm-hmm. And the word mindful was not in there to begin with. Mm-hmm. It was authentic, actually. Mm. But somehow mindful snuck its way back in.
Gotcha.
And that became the subtitle. And it's confusing, you know. I think also I'm very happy about the book, and it's, you know, not just about romantic love, God knows, you know, but I think people sometimes think it will be.
Yeah.
So the very word love is quite confusing for us.
Yeah. One of the things I noticed about real love that I've told you before is that just in terms of this notion of our cultural narrative being so key to any spiritual path, you know, with my book, I took one famous cultural narrative in The Princess Bride. But one of the things that really resonated with me about real love is how many different cultural voices you used in quotes and so forth. So clearly that seems super important to me, like that our practice happens within this larger context of a culture where there's all these ideas and practices and art and politics and all of that moving around. So I don't think yours was a pop culture book, but the amount of cultural voices you brought into talking about, you know, a meditative book on real love was culture is important.
Thank you. You know, it was a big effort. So I'm going to actually quote you, okay? From the book, because as you keep saying, there's no such thing as a relationship expert, which I completely support. One of the pieces of publicity for my book that I had not seen before it went out, somehow I asked to see it too late. And the first line said something about me, like from the world's foremost authority on love. And I thought, oh, my God. So they were very gracious about changing that. But the first interview that I did, the person had that piece of paper in front of them, and they said something like, how do you get to be the world? And I said, never mind. No one is an expert on love.
Right.
So here's what you say. Guess what? Everyone is bad at relationships, at least when it comes to making mistakes. In my humble opinion, nobody is great at this dance of desire, love, and humanity. While I might be considered a relative authority on meditation or Buddhist psychology, I'm definitely no master of relationships, and I don't think anyone else is either. So that's a great take on a myth that someone is going to impart the secret to oneself, and then everything will be fine from then on. No struggle, no difficulty.
Right. Just for the disclaimer, I do go on in that passage to say, let me be clear, I'm not saying that some seeking guidance if you're having a difficult relationship isn't a helpful thing to do, that there are people very well trained to help guide relationships and receive feedback and therapy. It's just that's not expertise is the wrong word.
Yeah, I totally agree. And even just having a kind of dispassionate ear, you know, listening to one's conversation, because communication is so challenging. Mm. And sometimes from the outside, you know, you can just see these two people, whether it's parent and child or siblings or lovers or whatever it is, and mm-hmm. you think, in some way, you're not that far apart, but you can't stand to be in the same room with each other, you know? Like,
yeah.
Surely there's another way of saying what you want that, right. you know, might get you what you want.
It's, I mean, especially with, you know, another quote from the book is Chogyam Trungpa talking about family. And I think in a sense, he's also talking about just our close relationships. But it's not a quote I've ever seen written, but four or five of his students have said that he said this, that it's possible you could become enlightened everywhere except around your family.
Oh, that's interesting. Here's a quote from you. When it comes to family, the biggest obstacle facing meditators is the unrealistic expectation that our practice is supposed to make us invincible. We often feel like we should be able to handle anything and everything. Because we have some relationship with our own minds, sometimes we think that we should be superheroes when it comes to dealing with difficult circumstances. We should dive into family, and no difficulty should be able to overcome us.
Yeah, yeah. And then in the later chapters on family, I say, like, you could, if you're just starting with meditation, you wouldn't go on a month-long retreat. You'd start with, like, well, I know, I actually do know a few people who that's how they start with meditation, but wouldn't advise it, right? And same thing is, like, if you're struggling with a particular family relationship, maybe you could just have a little bit that. But I think a lot of times when we study, a lot of times out of context, Buddhist teachings and mindfulness teachings seem very idealistic about what we're supposed mm-hmm, to be able to mm-hmm. handle or accommodate. And so viewing relationships as a practice, as a difficult practice with some of the same parameters of like, what does it mean to just show up and practice in a way that's reasonable for you, I think is incredibly important. And also, I mean, I'll take back the Buddha was a deadbeat dad comment, even though it's in a
it's
book
cute.
That's already been printed. You know, I think there's some assumption that so-called spiritual teachers wouldn't be having any of the obstacles we're mm-hmm. having. And mm-hmm. clearly that's not the case when you get in. Mm-hmm. It's really just the great masters, I think, are just the ones who are practicing and have committed mm-hmm. to, like, I'm going to keep practicing with this. And so I think that's really important that we take an approach that, like, this is all of this is a practice, and relationships can be a really difficult practice. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to let ourselves actually admit to some of the obstacles we have in relationships, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, I think obviously the myths and the narratives and the stories of the West about love are very, very difficult. Mm. You know, in some ways I think love has really gotten degraded in general, that we tend to think of it as sentimentality or right. something that'll make us weak or even stupid rather than seeing it as the force that it is. But something that's great about Western culture is that people, I find, kind of insist on a real integrity to their practice. You know, mm-hmm. they don't want to have some activity they do to feel better in the morning but have a crummy life, you know.
Right.
They actually want that practice to manifest in their relationships and in their livelihood and, you know, all the aspects of their life. And that, I think, is a fantastic thing. And
yeah. It's also, you know, it's something, if you look at the progression of, like, for example, the Tibetan tradition, which is the one I'm kind of the most familiar with historically, and then the Shambhala tradition, which comes out of that, you know, there is sort of this progression towards even the notion that a householder at a certain point could be a master.
Mm-hmm.
And but even within some of the stories of, like, ancient Tibetan Buddhism, like, there were householder gurus or masters who, like Marpa would be an example, who was a farmer and also was a great translator of Dharma. But even there, it was almost like his farm work, and he had a temper and relationship with his wife, was almost like the way that he prepped for his real Dharma practice, mm-hmm. his real practice. And I think it's evolving, and I really like the Shambhala term warrior, you mm-hmm. know, which is not only used in Shambhala, but really this notion of a person who's trying to be awake in the world. And I do think we're kind of in a lot of these different traditions, we're in the early phases of a kind of westernized approach to Dharma, which I think some purists are saying is not the real thing, but where you're literally saying, okay, I'm going to do my daily meditation practice. I go on a couple retreats a year, but I'm going to really try to make my life in the world my practice.
Mm-hmm.
And not as a lesser practice to serve the monastic or yogic community that's doing the real practice. There's mm-hmm. a lot of, throughout Buddhist history, in Asian Buddhism, this notion that the lay people are doing just enough so that the real, they're the amateurs and the professionals are the people who are really willing to go deep. And there's a reason for that. I mean, it's hard to really devote your whole life to meditation practice.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a beautiful path to say, like, when I'm, when I'm writing, that's my practice. When I'm with my family, that's my practice. Mm-hmm. When I'm mm-hmm. with a stranger, that's my practice. When I'm getting trolled by a Trump supporter on Twitter, even though those numbers seem to be dwindling a little bit, that's...
Well, it's like a whole village in Estonia or something that's making its living by doing that.
So there's, when I'm doing any of this, it's my practice. And it's my, not just practice, like, until I get to the real practice, but this is my means of awakening.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I really like in the Tibetan Lojong tradition, and I put this in the chapter in the book on dating, there's a phrase, train without bias in all areas. So there's kind of a more, there's the mm-hmm. possibility emerging in Western mindfulness, Western Buddhism of, and I think it's part of because of where Western culture was and also part of the evolution of mindfulness in Buddhist mm-hmm. thought, of this notion of like, maybe in the 22nd century, the people who are considered the awake masters will be more like Renaissance mindfulness practitioners. You know, they have a strong meditation practice, but they're really demonstrating that in multiple areas of life, especially the difficult ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you don't have to demonstrate mastery in the difficult areas of life.
Mm-hmm.
I've learned this, more than any other relationship with my relationship with my wife, that you just have to demonstrate that you're trying to practice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So how many different areas of our life are we trying to turn into a practice based on the principles mm-hmm. we work with in meditation? That's what I think the 21st, 22nd century awakened mm-hmm. masters are going to mm-hmm. look like. Not that we won't have the yogis or,
mm-hmm,
I mean,
mm-hmm.
I'm also saying this, the most famous person in my tradition is a nun. So there's right, still that right, tradition right, very strongly.
Right.
But that's what inspires me at least.
So I have one more question about relationships, and then I wanted to switch topics before we have to.
Sure.
We have to end. So in terms of that phrase, as you wish, in that sense of devotion, something I was very conscious of in writing my book was how many people, most commonly perhaps women, but not only women, need the opposite in order to come to a state of balance or authenticity. Mm. Like they're always deferring, pretty well always deferring or giving in or not even being able to express what they want. I have a story in there about a friend, in my book, about a friend who really outlived her cancer prognosis by like 30 or 40 years, something like that. And she was telling me about when she was first diagnosed, and she said she looked at absolutely everything in her life, like everything.
Mm.
And she said, one of the things I saw was that I was the kind of person who'd be sitting in the car with my husband, boiling hot, and the most I could bring myself to say was, "Are you warm, dear?"
Mm.
And she said, that had to change, So I admire the beauty of devotion in that sense of as right. you wish. I was really happy. Ethan has a book launch, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. And the RSVP was as you wish, which I thought was really cute. And there are ways in which there are times in my life where I feel like that's the, getting into that mode is much more the movement toward authenticity. And then right. there are the opposite times as well.
Yeah, yeah. So, those relationships that are, I hear the issue that and maybe there is a gendered thing. I mean, I think we are, and as a white heterosexual white male, need to acknowledge in 2017 that we are still living in a very misogynistic, racist, homophobic society. It would just be silly. To not.
Yeah.
So there might be a gendered thing going on there, but to universalize the principle, I think, a a kind of confused notion of devotion, I think, can lead to kind of what I like to think of as talked about in The Road Home as doormat compassion.
Mm-hmm.
That it's just whatever you want, whatever you want, whatever you want. And that obviously opens the doors for people who don't understand boundaries, do not have generous, you know, are not returning the favor.
Mm-hmm.
For mm-hmm. narcissists to literally run the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's what that opens the door for. So spiritual practitioners have to be the ones to figure out generosity, devotion in a way that equalizes self and other. That's the theme that I always liked from one of the Tibetan teachings, that the mm-hmm. true bodhisattva equalizes self and other, cares about both. And there's a kind of a balance of the mind's awareness of self mm-hmm. and other. Which is really wonderful, like when you look at different cultures that have existed, that notion of like that a person could step onto the subway and equalize self and other, you know. Now the Dalai Lama sometimes makes the point, but there's more others. So if you're going to equalize the two, you're probably going to end up thinking about others a lot. But I think in terms of committed devotional relationships, I mean, I think those are rare, that there are relationships that you would just immediately say as you wish.
Mm-hmm.
For me, definitely a guru relationship, you know. If you ask me for anything, I would definitely say as you wish. You know, so what is it that makes that possible? Mm-hmm, I think mm-hmm. there's some kind of, my wife, I would definitely say as you wish, who has no problem telling me when she's at least physically uncomfortable, which is good.
Yay.
She has, you know, she sometimes really takes the burden on in other ways. But
yeah.
If it's too hot, she'll let me know. There's a quality of trust. You know, that not every fight has to be, not every situation has to be a time to either to express your needs.
Mm-hmm.
And so you trust that the relationship is going to be open enough and thoughtful enough that in the future you could bring it up again. And that does sound like an example of a non-trusting relationship, which I actually talk about trust as a basic practice of friendship in
mm-hmm.
the first
mm-hmm.
section of the book, because I was sort of going with increasing degrees of difficulty almost, the friendship, mm-hmm. romance, and
mm-hmm.
family.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's not true for everyone, that's the degrees of difficulty. But I think mutual trust is so important that and there's so many different kinds of relationships in terms of friendship, romance, family, where different language is used. You know, you go to different cultures, people could just be like, turn off the damn heat. And it's just viewed as compassionate to say that, whereas others would be way too forward. But it's a mutual language that's established.
Yeah.
And I think it's really good to look for those as kind of the most important relationships we have, because it allows us to really believe in our own awakened nature.
Mm-hmm.
But they're rare, you know, and they have to be cultivated.
Yeah.
And I do think if you are in a position that is historically oppressed in that way, meaning pressed against so that you're not able to equalize self and other with self in mind, assertion is the way
to
go,
you
know, which is why it's not all lives matter.
Yeah.
You know, we're not saying all cities matter while Houston is under underwater. We're saying Houston matters.
What about Northampton, though? Talking about Northampton.
So I think that's an important practice for modern practitioners. And I think it's important for people who want to be their allies to give space for them to be like, okay, you know what? I'm going to let you talk. So at this point, I'll stop mansplaining.
No, that was great. That was excellent. I face that a lot with my own book, you know, that question a lot with my own book and that sense of, if I talk about love as generosity, well, what about the people who, you know?
Yeah.
And so that equalization is really important. I call it mutuality, you know, but all words are a little complex because mm-hmm. mutuality sometimes, I think, makes one think of a ledger, you know, like, well, you did three great things for me, you know, so I guess I owe you three, you know, but it's not like that at all. It's exactly as you're describing it. So then before we end, you know, lest people think I'm completely ignorant of popular culture and I live in a little box or something, I was totally addicted to The West Wing. So I haven't been able to commit again since, you know, in quite that wholehearted fashion. So let's talk about politics.
Okay.
You are as well known as you are in terms of Buddhist psychology and meditation, I think your commitment to transformational activism is even more, you know, the way people would associate. If they heard your name, they'd go, yeah, I read his thing on, you know, something like that.
Yeah. I always have to say that I always feel a little sad that I'm considered a politically active Buddhist teacher, because I always feel like I'm just doing the bare minimum of a citizen of democracy and as a person interested in interdependence, a core Buddhist tradition. But, you know, to speak of mentors, I've been able to work with sort of what is the combination of a personal mindfulness practice and some kind of interest in our systemic collective. And then there's this middle piece, which is what this book's all about, the interpersonal level. But what is the relationship between a personal practice and an interest in our systemic and collective practices? And, you know, you've been a mentor in that work, and our mutual friend, Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, you know, has been a real Roshi, Acharya, in that arena as well. And, you know, so I think there's, you know, what's interesting about the current situation is I think it's really easy to misuse Buddhist principles and principles of any non-dualistic Eastern tradition in a way that dovetails with, like, what I've come to feel is like the core propaganda model of our time. Like, I don't think we live in a very Orwellian space. I think we live in a space of false equivalence where what is helpful and what is harmful, there's no discernment of relative truth. And so it's very easy, since Buddhist and non-dualistic traditions talk so much about ultimate truth, it's very easy just to say, like, you know, and I think in Charlottesville we saw the extreme absurdity of this, when it's like all sides are causing problems. And it's like, that is a worldview that has zero interest in relative truth. And it's so easy to dovetail that with a confused understanding of shunyata or emptiness or non-duality. And there does need to be an inclusiveness. And I think the inclusiveness is love and showing up and connection and wanting to be connected. But I do think that people who teach these traditions, a lot of what we can offer are because we do more of the personal work and the interpersonal work. But a lot of what we can offer is really an understanding of how a person could cultivate a view that balances the relative truth. Like, some actions are harmful, some actions are helpful, some people are struggling more than others, you know. It actually doesn't hurt a billionaire to realize that we need to take care of immigrants too. It actually would help from a Buddhist interdependence standpoint. The better off immigrants are, the better off the billionaire is going to be. Might not be a billionaire anymore, but I don't know. You know, so I think it's this really interesting place where I find myself just really interested in the conversation of what is our view. And another term that's been really important to me was a phrase coined by a Buddhist psychotherapist named John Wellwood, who coined the phrase spiritual bypassing, which I dedicated a whole chapter in The Road Home to. And one of the ways he defines spiritual bypassing, I thought, is so helpful for people who are studying meditation or Buddhism, which is that spiritual bypassing often involves privileging ultimate truth and neglecting relative truth. And so I think that's really important, that those of us who and also with transparency, you know, I've been thinking about the people who are more active in terms of just, you know, getting people to vote, et cetera, and using their voice, like yourself, like Angel Kyoto Williams, like Roshi Joan Halifax, like dear friend Michael Stone, who I co-authored a letter with during Occupy Wall Street, who passed away this summer. You know, I think it's important to have a perspective. I think just like we want to be transparent with our relationships as so-called spiritual teachers, I think it's also important that students know that we have certain views on the world, that and how we are applying our spiritual principles to get to those views. And, you know, I have a few Republican students. I actually think they respect me more for being willing to say what I think about certain things than if I was just like, both sides have a perspective. And it's like, yeah, of course both sides. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing is like, if you just distance yourself from the whole thing, ultimate truth is like, it's just the easiest way out of anything. Yeah. It's like, yes, I know everyone has a perspective. So I just think I would urge people who are thinking of teaching meditation, teaching any of these traditions, to be compassionate, to be open, to demonstrate and model practicing listening, and to provide space for disagreement in whatever sanghas or communities you have, but to actually share your perspective on specific matters. Mm-hmm. I think it's actually a better teaching method for everyone.
That's very interesting. Really being honest, you know, just being truthful.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have been very passionate and remain very passionate about people voting. And
I've never seen you angry except when you hear that people have the option to vote. And it's the only time I've ever seen you on the verge of anger.
Oh, shucks. But, you know, and it's interesting seeing the anger that's coming back because I don't tell people who to vote for, you know.
You don't.
But I think, just as you were saying, I think the active expression of belief in one's innate dignity, mm-hmm. or right to be happy, mm-hmm. is the vote in a political sense. And for people not to care or to say, in a sort of modern version of everything's empty, to say both sides are the same, you know. Somebody said that to me. This last election, presidential election, and I said, you know, you can say the difference between the two candidates is marginal, but a lot of people live on those margins. You know, it's like a raise in minimum wage makes a big difference if you're living on minimum wage. You know, it doesn't matter to you maybe, but and they voted, but you know, it was interesting seeing just the pushback against me just saying everyone should vote,
right?
And so there's a lot of feeling, you know, clearly. And I'm sure there's a lot of feeling, not just the trolls, you know, but from Estonia, wherever they are, you know. But, you know, like I follow you on Facebook and I follow you on Twitter. I don't always read the comments. I don't know if you do or not. But, you know, I'm sure a lot of them are heated.
Yeah, and some of them just change the subject, you know. That's another, the argumentation that's just like, okay, I'm not even going to listen, I'm just going to take this in a different direction. And a lot are very, you know, thoughtful. And I think, you know, there's certain principles of mindful listening, right speech, where you can tell if somebody's really wanting to engage a conversation. Mm-hmm. And if I ever act out of, you know, my own karmic confusion to not see the possibility of listening to somebody's point of view when there is that opportunity, I don't think social media is the best place for a conversation. It's more a good place for announcements. I do think it's worth trying, and I don't think it's a problem for people who are meditation teachers, yoga teachers, to actually want to mix it up and say, okay, how are you applying the mm-hmm. principles of your practice to the decision that you're making? Let's get into it. How am I applying the principles mm-hmm. of my practice? Mm-hmm. If you think you can call me on something, let's do it. You know, I think there's a kind of real willingness to mix it up that I'm interested in. Obviously, when it's not hurtful and you know, the tricky part is that there are certain actors who use those methods of communication. Like a lot of the Buddhist principles on right speech and good listening actually work best in friendship because they assume a trusting intention on the part of both participants. They don't assume that one, you know, might work for a major advertiser or one might work for Vladimir Putin, you know. And the other might just be trying to peddle his new book, you know. So there's assumptions that aren't always – sometimes it's good to establish, you know, trust. So that's in the last section of the book, I think. I posit – do you know who one of the biggest fans of The Princess Bride is? Senator Ted Cruz. Is
hello
an amazing – he does amazing impressions of characters from The Princess Bride. So actually – Mandy Patinkin wrote a op-ed piece in Time when he found this out. Mandy Patinkin's a, you know, progressive New York meditator as well. And I was able to talk to Mandy Patinkin about my book and just saying, like, you know, that he thought Ted Cruz missed the point of the movie. And but I was thinking, like, what would I do if Ted Cruz were a member of my family? You know, and I do have members of my family I probably disagree with politically. I think most of us do.
I may have met them at your wedding. I'm not really sure. We didn't talk politics.
Yeah. So, you know, we would probably talk about The Princess Bride, you know. It's not always the best. I mean, if we never talked about politics, I feel like that wouldn't be really being a warrior in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But it might be good to start saying, like, understanding somebody's narrative. And that's the thing about pop culture, is it allows for a shared narrative, even if a lot of the narratives that we have are not shared at all. You know, I do not share Fox News's narrative.
Yeah, I don't either. But I'm going to go watch The Princess Bride.
But yeah, if you could, there's a lot of Fox News viewers who would love The Princess Bride. And you can say, hey, this is about friendship. This is about working together. This is about not objectifying love. This is about thinking of your family as bigger than you thought of your family as. That might just be my progressive or libtard interpretation.
I can see it now. You on the stage with Ted Cruz and...
It'd be great. I would love it. I would love it. I mean, his impression. He does an impression of Billy Crystal's Miracle Max. You can YouTube it. That's just like really, really excellent.
Wow. Well, I know you need to go teach, actually. So is there anything else about your book that you'd like to share before we...
No, it was... I think it was a good balance of the personal, the theoretical... the cultural, and it's really the kind of book I like to write, is, you know, a very heartfelt offering, you know, talked about some deep things, like the last time I saw my grandfather before he committed suicide, talked about some very playful things, like what's the most Buddhist line in The Princess Bride. Mm-hmm. So,
what is the most Buddhist line?
A lot of people, I shared this with Dan Harris, a lot of people think the most Buddhist line is when Wesley says to Buttercup, "Life is pain, Highness. Anyone who says differently is selling something." But I think that's almost Buddhist. It's sort of the dark side of Buddhism without the light. So I think the most Buddhist line in The Princess Bride, and I would love to hear what other people think it is when Fezzik says to his best friend Inigo Montoya, as the dread pirate Roberts is, the man in black is coming to duel with Inigo Montoya, and he's wearing... his mask, Fezzik says to his friend, "You be careful. People in masks cannot be trusted."
Whoa. That is so great. Well, I want to encourage absolutely everybody to, at this moment, pre-order the book because it's coming out September 12th. So, and if you listen to this or are moved to buy it later, then order the book, but certainly pre-order the book. And I think we should all send Ethan our view of what the most Buddhist line is from the book. So I would follow him on Twitter. I'll have to tell him, have to get him to tell you what his thing is, and also Facebook. And you can pre-order a copy right now by visiting www.ethannickturn.com. It's ethannickturn. And also, Ethan and I are teaching a weekend retreat together on love and relationships at the Shambhala Center in New York City, September 29th to October 1st. So come be with us. Thank you so much, Ethan. Why don't you just tell us how to find you, other than your website, which
sure,
I just mentioned.
Sure, the website, and then Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, all of those. It's just Ethan Nickturn. One word is the handle, at Ethan Nickturn. So ethannickturn, at that.
That's great. That would be so wonderful, because then if you follow him on Twitter, every time he and I have dinner together, you'll see a photo, because that's what we do. We ritualistically take photos and post it on Twitter. Somebody in a restaurant once came up to us and said, "Are you actually going to look at each other at all? Or are you just going to be on your phones all night?" But we don't stand.
It's a nice thing for two meditation teachers to hear, right?
Great. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sharon.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has been brought to you by the Be Here Now Network. Join us this summer for the Real Love Challenge, To get your copy of Real Love, visit SharonSalzberg.com. May all beings be happy.